I want to welcome you all back. Welcome to the Senate. It's good to see the senators taking their coats off because this is the House, and actually ties are not required either. This is the People's House, and so we're glad you can come to engage in that.
People too.
Really? Cool. I thought you were a senator. Okay. anyway, so Commissioner, why don't you come up? We are fortunate to have our commissioner here to address us today for a few minutes. She has to run off after this to another meeting, but. So we have a bunch of things to do. We're going to talk about Merck and hear about some health articles. Commissioner, these are fascinating topics. Not your topic, I guess. But anyway, welcome to the committee, and nice to have a few minutes to share with us. And you're welcome anytime.
Okay. Thank you so much, Representative Adler, Senator Hant, and to all of you other conference committee members. Thanks for the chance to say a few words at the beginning of your process. I think one of the challenges of the legislative process, at least for me, is sometimes to keep track of what the different branches of government and houses are doing. So it's good to see that we're all here in the same room, if not yet on the same page. But let me just start by repeating what I know I said to many of you just a few weeks ago. While there are significant differences between Governor Dayton's proposals and those made in your Health and Human Services bill, there are certainly also areas of agreement, and I remain confident that we will find numerous areas for cooperation and agreement. The governor's position is that the administration cannot negotiate on conference committee bills until there's a single legislative position. And we wouldn't want it to be perceived as taking sides either between the House and the Senate. But having said all that, I see this this process as holding the real opportunity for dialogue, to learn from each other. Which is why I appreciate the opportunity to say a few words. We have a couple of concerns I just want to make you all aware of, and one of them is really our concern of regarding the target. Now, I know one or two of you may have concerns about that as well, but from our perspective, you can't reduce the human services budget by $1.6 billion without doing real harm to vulnerable people and the services they depend on. And I must say, looking through your bills, I've read them all, I know I'll see places where I say, okay, I understand they're trying here to mitigate the impact that this other provision has. So I know that you have tried to work hard to mitigate the impacts on vulnerable people, but we are still very concerned about the reductions of this magnitude. Another concern is going forward, we need to have fiscal notes to back up the savings. I know that Commissioner Showalter in France sent a letter around which reflected some concerns I had spoken of earlier. I'm not going to repeat those here, but we do have to agree on the numbers. I must say I found this out kind of rather the hard way myself. So it's January, I've just started my job, and today is actually the 3 months. I've been in this job for 3 months. So I'm there on January 13th, and I'm trying to put this budget together quickly. And, you know, I come from my most recent background was in academia, so I'm, like, looking for ideas. So I like get, like, I brought a prop, the Health Reform, Health Affairs magazine, which is this, you know, nonpartisan policy magazine, and I'd go in and I'd say, okay, we could do this and save money and it would be good for people. Isn't that great? And people would look at me and say, Commissioner, that's a really good idea. That is reform. It probably will save money, but it's not bookable. So I'm a real goal-oriented person, and so my New Year's resolution for this year, made 2 weeks late, was instead of, you know, losing weight or learning French, I just am in search of bookability. But still wanting to do reform because it's the right thing to do. But bookability is the reality of budgeting. As you work through this challenging task, I do encourage you all to take a look at the governor's proposals for ideas. I mean, some of these proposals both houses agree on. Even more, one house or the other agrees on. We did work hard to develop and prioritize our budget, and I hope they will give you some ideas. You will give those ideas serious consideration as you move forward. And my staff and I are really very much here to help you through this during this process, to help you understand the governor's proposals, to provide technical assistance, to ensure that language is properly drafted, if that's of assistance to you. To explain the impacts of various proposals that you all may be considering, not just from a financial perspective, but with regard to kind of the administrative perspective, as well as the very human impacts that may result from proposals. Well, and certainly to provide fiscal analysis and fiscal help as you work through different options. So call on us, call on me, tell us when and where you want that help, and we will be there. And thank you for providing me the opportunity to say a few words at the beginning.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Any questions or comments for the Commissioner? Senator? Well, thanks for coming, and it's really nice of you to come in person. And just to letters, I think letters serve a purpose, but the face-to-face is productive as well. And I just want to commend your staff. They don't always agree with all our ideas, but their technical support has been very helpful. And they've been very candid with us in private meetings. And the headline today was that that somehow that letter poked a hole in our budget or something. And I'm fully aware of some of the challenges of that we've presented your department with. But, Commissioner, you know that I think that we have to push everybody. And as you push your even your own fiscal people on some of the ideas you have, I think you'll find as they rethink some of those suppositions, you might find bookability. And I hope that as this process goes on, that we can come to some agreement about how to serve those same people that we're also worried about and get an agreement that we can get out of here on time, which is my goal. And I know it's yours. And so I just wanted to commend your staff, too. So you're backed up by some very capable people.
Thank you. I think so as well, Representative Abler. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Hand, and all the rest of you.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Neal, you do want to say
and
something?
Commissioner, just a quick comment. Looking around the room, I think I'm the only member here, correct me if I'm wrong, that has signed off on a budget conference report so far that's headed to the governor that I believe he'll sign, at least the commissioner told us that he was going to highly recommend the governor sign that report. That was a much shorter conference committee than this one is going to be, obviously, the agriculture budget. But the commissioner was there, I believe, the entire time for it was only one day. But just setting that standard for you, Commissioner. But we did get some feedback from the department and from the commissioner, in particular about a provision that was in the bill that the Senate had and the House didn't, and the department said, we don't like this. So to the extent that we could keep you engaged in this process and get that feedback indirectly when possible, I would like nothing more than to be able to have a similar conversation and have you sitting in that chair saying, I'm going to recommend that the governor sign this bill. I would love to be able to get to that point, Commissioner.
Representative Abel,
yeah,
Senator, I want to be here as much as you need me to. I would promise to be here during everything if you would promise this would last one day.
And Commissioner, I think you have a little bigger department. Representative Gottwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see Dan Pollack sitting behind the commissioner, representing the governor's office, as I understand.
The commissioner. He represents the commissioner.
I'm sorry, he represents the commissioner. I get confused in all this gobbledygook of our administrative org charts. But I think the point can be made that in the interest of good government, I know there's been a lot of political semantics played around when the governor does or doesn't engage. And I think if we want to get our work done and do it thoughtfully, that having the governor's input, either through you, Commissioner, or through whoever it happens to be who's representing him at the table or himself personally, I think it would be really good to have that input even now as we're conferencing the bills, so that we're aware of where those areas of, as you put it, you mentioned significant differences and areas of agreement. I think we need to be as clear as we can about those as early as we can so that we can arrive at a real good solution for the state of Minnesota and get our work done on time. And I think that's in everybody's best interest. So I would offer that olive branch and that option to the governor and to you and to the Department of Health as well, Dr. Ellinger.
Well, Commissioner, maybe the paper should say early agreement on process. I think we're moving in the right direction. It's so good of you to come, and you're always welcome. And I know you have other things that keep you very busy, but please feel welcome anytime. And if you want that chair, it's open to you on a short notice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, members. We're going to talk about Merck today, and we're going to talk about the health article. I know that's why you all came to hear. If the presenters for Merck will come down, I think we're doing like 15 minutes on this topic, and then we're have an amendment to take to the House language, and then we're going to move into the health article. And I can just feel the excitement in the room building as we maybe I'm wrong about that. That way we already had the exciting part of the meeting. Welcome to the committee, and thanks for what you're going to tell us.
Well, I know I'm excited. just a question for staff. Is the presentation available for committee members? You don't have it? Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Diane Rydrick, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Division of Health Policy at the Minnesota Department of Health. And thank you, members of the committee and chairs, for having me here to talk about Merck. I'm going to give you a little overview in the next 10 or 15 minutes, giving some history of Merck, talking a little bit about eligibility, where the funds come from for Merck, and how they are distributed to eligible training sites. I'll let you know when I'm changing slides, since we don't have it on the screens here. And if I do get too far into the weeds on any of this, let me know, or if there are any questions, obviously. So just starting on the slide that has original Merck goals. Merck was first established in the form of a task force in the early 1990s, in 1993, when the health department was directed to examine the costs of graduate medical education in Minnesota and the revenues available to support it, and to develop a mechanism to recommend for funding GME in Minnesota. When it was established, it was explicitly set up to offset lost patient care revenue for teaching sites that were facing increased competition and a higher cost structure. At that time, there were concerns that with the growth of managed care, education providers would not be able to pass the higher costs that they faced from providing education along, and that could lead to providers no longer wanting to provide that education or being able to financially support it. In practice, there was no way to know whether any individual training site had experienced financial difficulties related to increased competition, so Merck funds were set up to go to all GME providers who met certain eligibility criteria. On the next slide, the underlying principles of Merck were that medical education, and I use that term broadly to refer not just to physicians, but also to the other providers that are covered by Merck, which include advanced practice nurses, dentists, pharmacists, and several others. It's a benefit to society as a whole, and not just to those sites who provide the training. As such, we all have an interest in having a robust GME system and in providing for a well-trained workforce. Given that, costs should be shared across the healthcare system. That was the foundation of Merck when it was established. Another underlying principle was that the funding for Merck should follow the training. It should go to the sites where trainees are having their clinical training, not to the individual grantee. These are not grants to an individual or scholarships to an individual. This is money that goes to that clinical training site. That was and is increasingly in outpatient settings. A few decades ago, anyone here who has a healthcare background knows that most training was provided in a hospital setting, as was most healthcare delivery. It is increasingly in an outpatient setting now, and so outpatient settings have always been a part of Merck, and a substantial portion of the funding has always gone to physician clinics and other sites. The final founding principle of Merck when it was established was that it should be responsive to workforce needs. The health workforce pipeline as a whole should support cost, access, and quality goals, and we should be providing incentives for the training of generalists, primary care providers, and dealing with geographic distribution issues. On the next slide, titled Merck Eligibility. Merck, as I mentioned just now, is a funding source for training sites that provide clinical training for physicians. So those are medical students who are doing their clerkships in a physician's office or hospital, medical residents and specialists, pharmacists, dentists, chiropractors, advanced practice nurses, and physician assistants. To be eligible, a site has to be funded in part by patient care revenue, and they must be a Medicaid-eligible site because these are Medicaid funds. The training has to take place in a patient care setting that faces increasing financial pressure, and it has to emphasize primary care or specialties that are in undersupply in Minnesota. On the next slide, use of Merck funds. Merck was first funded in 1996. The first distribution of Merck dollars was in 1998. Since 1998, roughly $500 million has been distributed through Merck. The size of the pool has grown over time to its current size of between $50 and $60 million a year. Funds flow from the health department to sponsoring institutions. So those are organizations like the Academic Health Center, which sponsor residency programs or training programs for other providers. Those sponsoring institutions pass funds along to the training site. So if the Academic Health Center has a surgical residency and those surgical residents are training in another office, the funding ultimately flows to that site for the for a portion of those costs. Facilities have to pass funds to the training sites within 60 days. Training sites can use those funds in whatever way they like to support that education program. There are no strings attached to the funds per the Merck statute, so they can use it to offset a portion of the salaries that they pay to students or residents if they pay salaries. They can use it to offset the costs of those physicians who are overseeing the students or residents, those preceptors, or they can use it for other costs associated with training. Many programs do like to use these funds as an incentive to encourage small sites to take on new residents. On the next slide, Merck formula timeline. This one gets a little detailed, so here's where I'll try not to get too bogged down. It's important to understand with Merck that there has always been some tension between two viewpoints with regards to how funding should be distributed. The funds for Merck come from the Medicaid program, but the funding is intended to cover the costs of training. And so there have always been divergent beliefs whether this is money that should be distributed based on Medicaid volume, because it is Medicaid funding, or whether it should be distributed based on the costs of training and should be used to offset a portion of those costs, since while it is Medicaid money, it's Medicaid GME money. The formula has changed over time in ways that reflect those divergent viewpoints. In its early years, Merck was explicitly set up to reimburse a portion of costs at these training sites. If you took on more trainees and you had more costs associated with those trainees, you got a larger grant from Merck. It was that had the benefit of being fairly simple to explain and to understand. You still had to be an MA site to be eligible, but the formula was based solely on costs. That started to shift around 2001 when we began receiving funding from the PMAP carve-out. That formula had a different distribution. It had a 50% cost and 50% MA volume distribution. In the mid-2000s, 2004, 2007, those two pools were combined, and the formula shifted again in a way that was designed to maintain the status quo, so to maintain that same balance between MA volume and training costs. There was also what was known as a discretionary fund for a few years, where 10% of the funds were set aside and sponsoring institutions could use them as they wished to distribute to any Medicaid-eligible site or any Merck-eligible site. So a sponsoring institution could choose to provide extra funding to one particular site that was just getting training started or that they wanted to provide incentives to for some reason. The current formula was established in 2007. And has now been in place for 3 years. It has now shifted kind of a 180 from where it was when Merck was first established. It is now, the formula is now based 100% on Medicaid volume. So we look at all of the sites that are in the distribution. We look at what the Medicaid volume is at each site. And the more that you have relative to any other site in the distribution, the larger Merck grant you get. There is also a 20% bonus for the highest volume site. So the Merck statute currently describes this 20% bonus payment for any site that has more than 1% of the Medicaid volume in the pool. So that essentially functions to give 15 to 20 large Medicaid sites an extra Merck bonus that comes at the expense of those who are below that line. There are also several direct payments that are part of the Merck statute. They go to the Academic Health Center, to the University of Minnesota Fairview, and to the U of M Dental School. Those were also put in place in 2007. The next two slides just give you a brief overview of where the money goes, which portions of the distribution go where, because there are several moving pieces with Merck, and where the money comes from. The first slide shows the source of funding for Merck. These are biennial figures. The largest piece of the Merck pool is from the PMAP carve-out. In the biennium, $99.1 million, so roughly around $50 million per year from the PMAP carve-out. The PMAP add-on payments are a series of direct payments that MDH is required to pass through to the Academic Health Center and to other providers. Federal match, $9 million in the biennium. Those are federal Medicaid matching funds that we receive on our cigarette tax, Merck dollars. And the cigarette tax forms the 10% slice of the pie down on the bottom right. That's $17 million in the biennium. The second budget slide shows how the funds are distributed, not to distinct sites, but just as a portion of the Merck program as a whole. The annual distribution of Merck funds to qualified sites is about 70% of Merck. That's a distribution that happens once a year in December. There are several direct payments that we are required to make. One is to HCMC, $2.1 million in the biennium. $2.2 million in the biennium for the Clinical Dental Innovations Grant Program. There's $150,000 a year for administration. A pass-through payment of just over $39 million in the biennium to the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center. And then the other direct grants that I mentioned are just over $10 million in the biennium. So the next couple slides give you an overview of where the Merck money from that general annual distribution goes. This information at the top of the slide is from the most recent distribution in December of 2010. In 2010, there were 635 distinct sites around the state that received Merck grant funds. 85% of the funding went to hospitals, just under 10% to physician clinics. It's important to note that because of the way the formula works, that doesn't quite match where training takes place. When we look at where training is actually happening, using data from the Merck application, 23% of the FTEs being trained in that year were in physician clinics, and 67% were in hospitals. 70% of the grant goes to Hennepin and Ramsey counties. The table down on the bottom of the slide gives you a sense of how that has changed a little bit over time as the formula has changed. So in 2000, that was a purely cost-based formula, and you can see how the grants were distributed to those four counties, which received the majority of the funding. In 2007 is when we started, it was the last year before we went to the current formula, the total MA formula. And 2010 shows the current formula with a 100% MA basis and that 20% bonus for the largest MA sites. So you can see in general, Hennepin County has been held pretty constant throughout those formula changes. In general, that's because the largest provider there, HCMC, has a high volume of training. They also have high MA volume. So no matter what the formula looks like, Hennepin County generally does fairly well under that and is one of the largest recipients. Ramsey County did better under the current formula. Olmsted is where you'd see the biggest decrease in the number of in the size of their grants based on the current formula. And St. Louis roughly holds constant over the years. Figure on the next page, again, just gives a short snapshot of what the distribution looks like under the current formula. The majority of the funding goes to 20 large sites. Just over three-quarters of the funding in 2010 went to the top 20 sites. We do have an increasing concentration down at the bottom of the distribution as well. We had about 20% of sites in 2010 that got less than $1,000. As a side note, the smallest grant in 2010 was 14 cents. The next slide shows you the top 10 or so Merck recipients, top 10 hospitals. In 2010, they're organized based on the size of their grant in 2010. So the largest went to HCMC with just under $9 million. As I mentioned, HCMC is also one of the largest providers of medical education in the state. So they have a very high number of FTEs as well. The final column on the right there is just a reference point. Because the formula has moved away from a focus on costs of training or number of FTEs, we do see sometimes some interesting patterns in terms of the size of the grant per FTE at individual sites. So just among these top 10, it ranges from 5,500 per FTE at St. Mary's in Rochester to a high of 145,000 per FTE at St. Cloud. The next slide, one of the last ones, shows you that in a slightly different way. This just gives you a sense of the range of grants. In the 2010 distribution, we masked the names of the sites, but these are actual FTE counts and grants. The largest grant per FTE was for a site that had 0.39 FTEs over the course of a year and got a grant of $935,000. The smallest grant per FTE was 5 cents for a site that had nearly 16 FTEs and got a grant of about a dollar. The last slide just gives you a very, very quick overview of what's in each of the proposals for Merck, because I know Merck can get pretty confusing. Both the governor's proposal and the Senate's proposal reduce the size of the Merck pool by making some cuts to the size of the PMAP carve-out of varying sizes, and both eliminate the direct payments that are part of Merck, but neither make any changes to the distribution formula. The House proposal repurposes those direct payments. Instead of sending them to the Academic Health Center, University of Minnesota Fairview, and the Dental School, they are redirected to other recipients, and the formula is changed so that the tobacco money, cigarette tax money, and match is distributed to hospitals only based on MA volume. PMAP carve-out funds are distributed based on costs for training, with incentives for rural, outpatient, and primary care. Any change to the formula does require federal approval, so the language in the House is set up to be contingent on that approval being received, and if it were not, it would revert back to a slightly modified version of the current formula. So that is about as quick of an overview as I can give of Merck.
Well, that's, I think it's very succinct and helpful. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Ridrich. I have a couple questions for you quickly. On the last page, the page 7, I guess, the bottom slide shows dollars per FTE. Now, am I reading that correctly to say that Site A has less than a person who's being trained there? Some portion of training is going on for one person at that site, for which that site is getting $936,000. Is that correct?
Ms. Roderick?
Senator Hahn, members of the committee, yes, that is correct.
And so, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Roderick. So, if Merck is to be used to educate medical personnel, how in the world does that work for Site A? Is $936,000 being spent on that one fraction of an individual there to do that person's training?
Ms. Friedrich.
Yes, Senator Hahn, members of the committee. As I mentioned in my presentation, sites can choose to use these funds in the way that they see fit to support their training program. It's unlikely that they would be spending that amount of money on that 0.4 FTE, but they could use it to compensate others who are involved in the training program in some way, who are providing oversight, to pay a portion of infrastructure costs. They could use that in other ways.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Rudrick, I appreciate that. I just have to believe that since there are no strings attached, that $936,000 is being used probably for things that may be tangentially related to some training mission, but I'm just, and I know that you're not in charge of the formula, but I just want to point out that the formula itself may have some perverse impact. The other question I have for you very quickly, going back to page 5, where you're talking about the funding and where it comes from, and this is the 2012-13 base budget amount that you're referring to, $169 million. What is the base budget amount for the current biennium, the 10-11 biennium?
Ms. Friedrich.
Same. Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, it's the same.
It is the same amount. Sorry, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Friedrich, it is the same dollar amount year to year?
Correct.
When does that or how does that fluctuate? Does that have to be done by a direct appropriation or is it a calculation based on volume?
Ms. Friedrich, are you going to phone a friend here?
I'm going to phone a friend.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Julick. The first of many appearances I've had. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Here we go again.
For the record, my name is Barb Julick, Department of Health. The Merck funds that flow through the PMAP carve-out were capped 2 years ago, and so they don't grow with volume or with the MA forecast anymore. So that's capped. The direct funds were always capped, and the add-on has always been capped in statute. So it's a flat program.
Senator. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to either testifier. I'm back on the spreadsheet regarding Merck distribution on page 7 of our handout.
Yeah, St. Cloud's too high.
And I'm I'm just startled. I think I shared some startled looks across the table here at the disparity from Site A down to Site G, Site A with 0.39, Site G with over 15, and Site G we give $1. I would love to have that explained to me. How is it that we send a site with almost 16 FTEs a buck and call that efficient or effective? And then just the disparities. Can we get kind of a one-minute answer to how we get to this kind of disparity, or is that not possible?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Radrick.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald. The formula is based on the amount of Medicaid business that a particular site does, and it is not linked to the number of FTEs that they have or the costs associated with those trainees. So the formula is essentially blind to the number of FTEs that a facility has. I don't know offhand who is Site A, who is Site G, but Site A would have to be a site that, while they do not do a lot of clinical training that's eligible for Merck, they have relatively high Medicaid volume compared to other sites in the distribution. And that's the only thing that the formula looks at.
Representative Gottwald. Okay. Any other questions? Well, I think this is helpful. I just want to point out that if you look at the average, that's a very helpful presentation. And you can probably escape if you want. I just want to point out that about on the average, every 4 years since the program began, it's been changed significantly, and I thought I would do my part to help bring that discussion forward since we're about due. It's meant to create a discussion, which I've succeeded in. Representative Kiffmeyer is going to move my amendment, the A59 amendment, to put some things back sort of the way they were. This discussion will go on. Maybe if staff could explain the Kiffmeyer amendment to us, please.
Mr. Chair.
This is only to amend the House language. This is not an agreement. This is just changing the House side. So,
Mr. Chair and members, we're on the A59 amendment, and lines 1.3 to 1.21 of that amendment relate to changes in Merck, again, in the House language, and it removes language that would focus the program on addressing training in populations with health disparities, removes direct funding for the House redirected some of the funding, and it removes, I think, two of those direct funding sources, and then also returns the rest to existing language. That's that section. Then on line 1.23, the amendment removes the U of M scholarship program that was funded under the redirection of Merck funding. Line 1.25 removes the proposed Health Department Health Careers Opportunity Grant Program. Line 1.27 removes changes to the existing loan forgiveness program. On the second page, line 2.2 would remove a proposed health department scholarship program. Line 2.4 would remove, and line, oh yeah, 2.4 would remove a section adding an entity to a list of entities related to, or that can participate in an advisory group. And line 2.6 removes a section related to surveys of health professionals. Then the rest of that page removes language that would have refocused various programs to address populations that experience health disparities by removing language that was repurposing existing programs, including on line 2.23, we remove a section that would have modified the existing SHIP program. On the last page, line 3.2 removes a section that related to healthcare home demonstration projects and a community engagement provision. And then the last line removes, I think it's two riders that would have funded programs that are removed elsewhere in the amendment.
Thank you, Rep. Sinahan. Or Senator Hand, did you?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Do we have a motion then? Is this in front of us?
Rep. Senator Kiffmeyer moved it, and so it's to amend the House language only.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a question, and it may be process-oriented, but the fairly complex amendment involving changes over a number of pages and sections of the bill, do we get a revised pages in the side-by-side to reflect this change going forward, or how do we track this change? And secondly, does this imply any changes in the numbers in the spreadsheet? And if so, do we have to have a revised spreadsheet?
It's a fair question. It's customary that either side could amend their language at any time, and then later there would be an offer made of language or not offering language. I think if it's a complex enough change and if people want to see the new version, especially in this topic, it might be productive. And the staff could be asked to make an unofficial engrossment of those sections. And the spreadsheet changes will all be within that Merck section. The House actually did not cut or spend more money necessarily, it just repurposed a lot of the grants. And so I think it wouldn't be hard for Mr. Walls to have a supplemental spreadsheet to address that. If that's sufficient.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that would be sufficient for our, we just want to try to understand, we recognize it's House language. I don't even know, are we allowed to vote on this, or is this just going to be you folks over here voting on this?
Well, to change the book, we all have to vote. So. So what the staff has been asked to go through the health article as amended. So they'll now describe the changes in detail as they go through that after we complete this amendment.
I don't know if there's any questions from the rest of the Senate conferees, but
Senator Nino.
Just one clarifying question. Line 1.10, it says on the House language, page 36, line 34, delete the new language. Does that mean we automatically then reinsert the stricken number? I wasn't clear on that, if that needs to be in the amendment, or if that just automatically.
Ms. Cleveland.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Can you repeat your question?
On the amendment, line 1.10, where it instructs on page 36, line 34, delete the new language, I was trying to engross this as we were having a discussion, and I was unclear as to whether that would automatically reinsert the stricken dollar figure or if that needs to be included in the amendment.
Ms. Cleveland.
Mr. Chair and members, no, it would just delete the new language.
Other questions? Senator Newman, welcome to the it's great to have you on our health committee.
Thank you, Mr.
This
Chair.
Is a great experience to have you back in the House again. Is this still like you're right at home, sort of?
Your chairs are much better than those over in the Capitol.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, your amendment deals with Article 2, Article 5, Article 9, and just so that you can confirm for me, you are only dealing in this amendment with Merck funds. Is that correct?
Senator, Merck funds and related scholarships. I was one of those persons who took the four-year opportunity to repurpose a lot of it. And I learned a lot along the way as I created discussion. And so we actually repurposed scholarship funds, some loan forgiveness funds, and a whole bunch of items. And so this is putting them back basically to current law. And so a lot of the, and when they go through the amended form of the bill, you'll recognize that. So it covers, I think, 20 different pieces of paragraphs throughout the bill, pretty much putting them back to current law. So we're actually receding from our position of doing so many changes.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, it's Merck funds, scholarships, loan forgiveness,
and but there were some tribal grant funds, and we did our Senate Ms. Cleveland. Sorry, I didn't mean to bring you down there. Can you just maybe answer the question for the senator,
Mr. Chair and Senator? I think your question is which direct payments are still in the bill. Is that your question, out of Merck,
Mr. Chairman? My question is, what funds is your amendment addressing? It's one of those amendments that's difficult to read and plug into our book. I just want to have some comfort level, because apparently I'm going to be voting on this, and I want to have some comfort level as to what funds are we talking about. And so far, the chairman has identified Merck funds, scholarship funds, loan forgiveness programs. Are there any others,
Ms. Cleland,
that are addressed in your amendment?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the funding sources that are addressed are the direct payments out of Merck that the House position redesigns, and then also there's House or general fund money for the health department for the scholarship program. It would have been it was a scholarship program under the health department, and so that's the rider that's being taken out at the end. The loan forgiveness program doesn't change the dollar amount, so the bill as is and the bill with the amendment doesn't change the loan forgiveness dollar amount at all. It just would have repurposed a preference within the language, but that's what's being taken out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry to make it so complicated. Any other questions? Senator, so seeing none, are you prepared to vote?
Mr. Chairman, I would just say, I just want to commend you for taking on an ambitious goal. I mean, your ultimate goal was to repurpose. I think we've all seen from this formula that if Merck were to stay in, that certainly, you know, that is a laudable goal. And I just think I just want to speak to your heart in that regard, and what you want to do can be addressed. But my understanding also is that by changing this book, it doesn't negate the fact that this conference committee can still take either position as we go forward. It is just changing the House at this time right now. But going forward, we still, as a conference committee, have the final decision.
Correct, Representative Kiffmeyer. And the House had a position leaving the floor, which is an available position. The Senate took a whole different position with its changes in the grant programs. And so I think that gives incentive for all the people in the audience who care about Merck, and there's actually a goodly number of them here today since they know we're talking about it, to look and see how we can best get some outcomes for this, which is the question that arises about FTEs and 14 cents. And I think that one of the outcomes of this conference group can be to, committee can be to decide how better we can get our value out of this and who is giving us value. And it's a very interesting area to delve into. So, are you prepared to vote? I don't want to rush this, but we have. Anyway, so all in favor of the amendment to the House language, which is not an offer from the House, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It's adopted. Now we're going to proceed to the health article, which will include the language that you just amended. And if Ms. Cleveland, who I tried to promote to, and Ms. Kavanaugh too. I do want to point out that the Senate now has the cool black books, but the House has cool little tabs in their black books, and mine are in Korean. So how about that, huh? Anyway, so we're in Article 6, are we, or Article 2?
Mr. Chair and members, we're on House Article 2 and Senate Article 6, the side-by-side. I'll be going through the side-by-side summary document. So House Article 2, Section 1 is a House-only provision, and it would require a definition or changes the definition for administrative expenses, and it must be consistent with the definition of the NAIC. Section 2 in the House and 1 in the Senate are identical related to cost containment duties. Section 3 in the House and Section 2 in the Senate are similar, except that the Senate removes reporting requirements for physician clinics and the House does not, but both positions remove a reference to statutory Section 62J.41, which is repealed, I think, in both bills. Section 4 and Section 5 are House-only provisions. Section 4 would exempt certain small clinics from the current 2005 interoperable health electronic health records requirement and require or basically extend it to 2020. Section 5 in the House modifies current standards for electronic prescribing by requiring the Commissioner of Health to develop methods for inclusion of transmission of formulary exception and prior authorization requests. Section 6 in the House and Sections 3 and 5 in the Senate are related to Merck. The only Senate only modifies subdivisions 4 and 7, so I'll go through the House position. Subdivision 1 in the House modifies the definition of eligible trainee FTEs to permit nursing home facility training sites to be eligible for Merck funding. Subdivision 3 would add advanced dental therapists to the types of professions that institutions can train and be eligible for Merck funding. And it would also add an emphasis on primary care in rural areas. The Subdivision 4 is different in the House and the Senate. The House modifies the existing formula by removing a supplemental public program factor. Also, it provides a $1,000 minimum grant based on the proposed formula. And it also changes existing direct payments by ending the ones for the U of M Medical Center, Fairview, and the School of Dentistry and redirecting them to other entities. The Senate position in that subdivision is that they just get rid of all of the direct payments. Subdivision 5 in the House removes existing oversight, an existing oversight provision related to the submission of grant verification. Subdivision 6, there's no change. Subdivision 7 in the House, the amendment that went on just changed that section, and so it simply makes a technical change. And in the Senate, the Senate eliminates Merck distribution of a portion of the funds transferred under 256B. Subdivision 7A in the House, there's conforming technical changes related to the proposed distribution formula change. Same with Subdivision 8. Subdivision 9 removes a reference to the Healthcare Access Commission, because elsewhere in the bill, I think that's being removed. And then Subdivision 11 in the House is the proposed new Merck distribution change, which is distribution formula change, which is subject to federal approval. It would include one section that would be based on public program volume factor for hospital training sites, and a second is a weighted formula that would give preference to training sites of primary care professionals and sites in isolated and small rural areas. Section 7 is a House-only provision. It's the Alzheimer's disease prevalence and screening measures provision. On page 5 of your summary side-by-side, Senate sections 4 through 19 are all Senate-only provisions, and these are sections related to Wells and Bearings chapter, which is 103I. It adds the definition of board thermo heat exchanger and changing vertical heat exchange to board geothermal heat exchanger, and elevator shaft to elevator boring makes other small changes. Section 8 in the House was removed by the A59 amendment. Section 9 is a House-only provision, and it relates to elimination of this certain healthcare provider reporting requirements and then proposes sunsetting new reporting requirements. Senate sections 20, 21, and 22 are Senate only, and they're relating to the newborn screening. Section 20 would remove a reference to the recording of test results under the heritable and congenital disorders. And Section 21 removes a reference to and the ability of the commissioner to retain blood spots under that program. Section 22 requires the commissioner to destroy all samples immediately after testing unless the parents elect to retain the results, in which case the results would be retained for up to 2 years. The section also requires the commissioner to destroy all blood samples collected before August 1st of 2011, and it removes or modifies the commissioner's duties to maintain the registry of cases of heritable and congenital disorders that are detected and prepare a form for parents and adults to use to direct destruction of samples. House Section 10 on page 7 of this summary side-by-side was removed by the amendment, the A59 amendment. Section 11 in the House is House only, except that this section of law is repealed in the Senate's bill. The House would modify the definition of designated rural area for the purposes of the existing Health Professionals Loan Forgiveness Program. House sections 12 and 13 were removed from the A59 amendment. Or by the A59 amendment. On page 8 of the summary, Senate sections 23 and 24 are Senate only. Senate section 23 would permit the commissioner to award statewide tobacco prevention grants within available appropriations. And section 24 would permit the commissioner to award local tobacco prevention grants within available appropriations. Section 14 of the House language is House only, and it would require hospitals licensed in the state to submit information through the LeapFrog group as a method of publicly reporting patient safety. Section 15 is House only, and this has a conforming change to the environmental lab accreditation, which is Section 16, 17, and 18. They're all related to an environmental lab accreditation bill that was moving in the House. Section 19 is House only provision. This would require the Commissioner of Health to work with certain long-term care providers to examine the state and federal rules and regulations and require a report to the legislature by January 31st of 2012. Section 20 is House only, and this would require the Commissioner of Health to accept electronic transmission of applications for the nursing assistant registry. And Section 21 is House only. This would modify existing data reporting requirements for EMS licensees by making it permissive until July 1st of 2014 and removing the penalty for failing to report. And it requires the EMS Regulatory Board to convene a working group to redesign the policies related to data collection.
And Senate Section 25 is Senate only. This prohibits any person or entity from performing or attempting to perform human cloning. Senate Section 26, this is Senate only. This limits family planning special project grants to available appropriations. House Section 22 is House only, and this would require the White Earth Band, if it accepts direct payments from Merck, to establish and operate one or more health clinics in Minneapolis or greater Minnesota to serve members of their tribe. House Section 23 is House only. This requires the Commissioner of Health to distribute grants to community mental health centers for providing services to low-income consumers and patients with mental illness. House Section 24 is House only. This adds a list of culturally based community organizations that help to develop and implement the state's plan to eliminate health disparities. Senate Section 27 is Senate only, and this limits the health disparities grants that are provided to reduce immunization rates and infant mortality to be within the available appropriations. Senate Section 28, Senate only, does the same thing as the health for the health disparities grants for other health disparities, that these grants shall be limited to the available appropriations. House Section 25 was deleted in the amendment. House Section 26 is House only. That was amended to remove the language about health disparities. And this would add a requirement for grantees to receive CHIP funding by requiring that they demonstrate an engagement with local consumers, community organizations, and leaders. House Section 27 is House only. This requires certain CHIP grantees that are also a payment reform demonstration project to coordinate activities to improve the health of the communities and patients under both programs. House Section 28, this was amended in the amendment by removing the language about underserved communities. And this would require the Commissioner of Health to award grants to expand community health centers by establishing new centers in small or isolated rural areas. House Section 29 is House only. This requires local public health family home visiting programs to obtain permission from the family to share data with other family service providers and to select a lead agency and to coordinate available resources. House Section 30, this deals with the sale and possession of synthetic marijuana. The Senate has this in House File 57, which is currently on the Senate floor. House Section 31 is House only. This creates a limited food establishment as a type of food and beverage establishment and requires them to use equipment that is non-toxic and durable and permits them to request a plumbing variance. House Section 32 is House only. This permits an inspector operating pursuant to the state's food code to waive any plumbing or other facility requirements if the inspector deems such a waiver as appropriate and reasonable. House Section 33, 34, 35, 36 all deal with the synthetic marijuana, and all of these sections are dealt with in House File 57, which is again on the Senate floor. House Section 37 and Senate Section 29, these sections reduce the amount of cigarette tax revenue that is transferred to the Merck account, and the differences here are in the timing and the amount of the reduction of the revenue that's transferred. House Section 38 is House only, and this transfers the duties of the Commissioner of Health that is found in Chapter 62U to the Commissioner of Human Services. House Section 39 was deleted in the amendment. House Section 40 is House only. This requires the Commissioners of Health and Human Services to evaluate and recommend options for reorganizing a variety of regulatory responsibilities. These recommendations are required to be submitted to the legislature by February 15, 2012. House Section 41 is House only. This transfers the duties of the Health Economics Program conducted under Chapter 62J to the Commissioner of Commerce. House Section 42 is House only. This requires the Commissioner of Health to contract with an entity to study efficiency costs, service quality, and enrollee satisfaction data for for-profit HMOs relative to the non-profit HMOs, and report on the findings is required to be submitted by January 15, 2012. House Section 43 is House only. This establishes a Minnesota task force of prematurity to evaluate and make recommendations on methods to reduce prematurity and improve premature infant health care. House Section 44 is House only. This requires the Commissioner of Health to work with stakeholders to review, implement, and make recommendations related to efficiency for nursing home licensure. Senate Section 30 is Senate only provision, and this prohibits the Department of Health from spending state funds or accepting federal funds for family planning special projects or family planning services. And House Section 45 and Senate Section 31, these are repealers, And both the House and the Senate repeals statutes on expenditure reporting, prescription drug price disclosure data, prescription drug disclosure, cost containment reporting, and summer health care interns. The Senate only repeals the Rural Hospital Planning and Transition Grant Program, the Loan Repayment Program for Health Professionals, promotion of health care and long-term care careers section, the section on Health Professional Educational Loan Forgiveness Program, the section on the Comprehensive Advanced Life Support, and the subdivision regarding migrant health grants and subdivision on tribal government grants. And then the House repeals the donated dental services section. And the Senate and the House, or no, the Senate repeals some rules regarding the chapter, the wells and boring language. And that's it.
Ms. Cavanaugh, is that donated dental things, that was supposed to be a part of my amendment on the floor, I think, or in Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
Was that, yeah.
The donated dental is not repealed anymore. The summary is inaccurate.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Yes, not. Okay. I stand corrected.
Are there questions for anybody about this article from any members? I think we can get through Article 4. Is anybody in the audience that wishes to testify about Article 2? There'll be other opportunities later, but if there's something on your mind you want to say. We didn't publish this, but we're trying to give opportunities along the way. So, and by the way, we don't know how far we'll get on any given day. So if there's some pressing need, you think, to say something, I would, when I'm chairing, at least I'd entertain that. And Senator Han, I would expect that it also have similar thoughts. But seeing no one jumping up to testify. Oh, wait. And Mr. Ness, did you want to testify too? Oh, just you're helping out, Ms. Braze. Ms. Braze, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I heard you say that other opportunities, and I thought, well, since you're taking a moment, I'll just take note of just a few things. I just want to point out in particular Section 1, which is the consistent administrative expenses. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, that would be page 2. And that's the House language. And our concern about that is how the National Association of Insurance Commissioners actually defined administrative expenses. And there's been a lot of concern about this, that the administrative expenses not included in there are things called quality management and the data systems and things that we think could tie doctors' hands. So those kind of things get to be called patient care. And in addition to that, state and federal taxes are called patient care. So if you accept this definition, then it's a definition that we don't really believe is actually administrative expenses. We believe there's a lot of administrative expenses and other things in what would be left as patient care. And then I will mention the data transfer section. Now, see, because, Mr. Chair, I didn't know you were going to ask this, I wasn't...
It's all right.
I can't remember where it is, but it's 62U, and I can't... Oh, here it is. Page 14, section 38 in the House. And I know, Mr. Chair, you and I have talked about this. We have long been concerned about this section and the
Ms.
collection.
Ms. Brayson, are you on the language sections?
Page 14,
where
summary.
The summary.
Section
38. Section
38. Okay. I'm on the language piece. Do you know what page it is on the language? Ms. Cleveland, do you know? Page 14. And what page would that be on the language, Ms. Brace? Do you know? Ms. Cleveland, do you know what page she's on the language? Just to help us all know what specific language we're going to talk about.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Braze, are you talking about the transfer from 62U?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's 48. Mr. Chair and members, that's in the language, that's page R48, section 38.
Thank you. Ms. Braze.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And so I guess I just want the committee to know, rather than transferring it to the Department of Health, to the Department of Human Services, we have long thought this was actually wrong to do to patients, to require all the claims, the insurers to send all their claims to the health department, to a database in the state of Maine, now called OnPoint, and to give ownership of that data to the health department. And we have always wanted it to be repealed. And so rather than transferring it, we would prefer it to be repealed. And I believe there was one other.
Ms. Braze, just for your information, on line 63.33 and 34, that data collection is suspended. Effective, just for your information, just so you know, effective July 1, 2011 in the House language.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do realize that, and I'm sorry that I didn't make note of that. It is suspended, but it is not actually repealed. So the next legislature would be able to, you know, start it up again. And so it's always there, just sort of waiting to get going. And then the Alzheimer's disease, we have testified against the Alzheimer's disease because I know it's just now a study, but it's using the available data that has been collected through 62U, the database in Maine that we don't like, and we're concerned about the fact that rather than this being actual research, that this would be the Department of Health who and the Department of Human Services who would have more of an interest as a payer, and that this might be a way to come up with data and treatments that actually tie the hands and universalize health care in a way that doesn't meet the needs of various patients who are very different from each other. And did I tell you where that was? I don't recall if I did, and I'm sorry if I didn't. That was page 4 of the summary.
Thank you.
Section 7 in the House. And the last two sections I'm just going to make comment on are on page 2 of the summary and section 4 and section 5. So one of them has to do with an exemption for small clinic practices for the mandate on interoperable electronic health records. And we appreciate this exemption, and I'm sure that every small clinic appreciates this exemption. But we do not believe that everyone should be required to have an interoperable health record, because as soon as it's interoperable under HIPAA, as you know, there's no real protection. HIPAA is a disclosure rule. And so as soon as it's interoperable and it connects with everything, it'll be part of the National Health Information Network, and nobody will have any rights to not have their information off the grid and available to everyone who could access it. So we would like this to go further and to say that there would be that everyone would have the right not to be mandated for interoperable health record. And then the last one is electronic prescribing. It has the I guess this is not the one. I was thinking this was the one that that allowed people to wait, small clinics to wait to do electronic prescribing. And if I'm incorrect about that, otherwise we would like that also, so that everybody would not have to have an electronic prescription. And we would like to have the mandate on electronic prescribing to revert to what it used to be before last session. The last session it was a may do it, and then it became a must at the end of last session. So that's where we'd like that to go.
And Ms. Braze, I think this bill is silent on that. The intention of Section 5 is to give some flexibility and preauthorization of medications to those who are already doing it. So,
Mr. Chair, that's what I'm thinking. I perhaps had the wrong section.
Is that the end of your list? Okay, thanks for coming down. Well, we got about 3 minutes left. Anybody else want to offer any thoughts? I see a hand. And you could be like the last contestant. Come on down. You got 2 minutes to say hello to us. And we'll have a 1 minute saying goodbye, and we're going to be adjourning at 12:20.
Tomorrow.
At 2:20. Tomorrow is at 12:30.
1 o'clock.
Senator, do you want to announce tomorrow's meeting just before everybody runs out the door?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We're going to meet tomorrow at 1 from 1 to 2:30 in room 107 in the Capitol building, which is across the aisle from where we met yesterday. And I do not have at this time the article that we'll begin with. Maybe we'll just begin at the beginning, but we don't have that.
Okay.
I can't tell you that right now.
We'll wait to be just with excitement to think that that might be.
We'll and then to an email later today.
And then we're intending to meet on Monday. So if you're thinking you had to come back on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, enjoy your weekend this time anyway. So we'll try to be friendly to you all. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I know we have a lot on the table, so I'll make it short. For the record, my name is Brian Gao, staff member at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. We're concerned about the removal of language that affects policy around removing or reducing health disparities within the racial and ethnic category, specifically the sections 8, 10, 12, 13. I know that this was raised on the House floor, and members of the public have not had a chance to raise any objections to this. So we are concerned that with the removal of this language, it makes it much more difficult to direct services, funding, and focus on areas of health disparities within different ethnic and racial communities.
Now, just while I'm so you were just the amendment we just did. You're talking, Mr. Cowell. You're talking about the amendment we just did.
You mean
just now? Just that we adopted an amendment to go back to current law on a lot of those departments, on a lot of those sections. Is that
okay.
what you're
are
talking about now, or is there something else that you're talking about?
I'm not sure. Were those brought back?
Well, you can actually come back and you know after you've we adopted the A59 amendment, which actually took many of my efforts back to current law.
Okay.
And so I don't think anything we did took anything away from whatever current law is. But we just took out a bunch of new language and efforts to push things to more outcomes and more focus. And I was advised that might cause more trouble than help, which is sort of why we did that now. But if you, is there a specific section you were concerned about or just the whole idea of it?
As I understand it, there were attempts to make amendments to remove the language, the words racial and ethnic from those sections. Did those go pass?
Actually, Mr. Cowell, in many cases, we took the entire section out. So what you have now in front of us is current law. So if, just for your information, whatever was in current law exists now and is not being proposed to be changed. And so maybe if you want to even chat with me offline. Mm-hmm. But this amendment is here. The staff will actually have, I've asked staff to re-engross Article 2 for us for Monday probably. And there'll be a new spreadsheet at some point to reflect those grant changes. But just so the public knows, all that the amendment did was restore a lot of current law and a lot of current programming back to how it was. So there's been no erosion of anything that currently exists in protection or in focus or anything. It's just a change in the House's approach to how it was trying to do something different. But thanks for coming down, and I know you'd be in touch. I appreciated our earlier discussions as well.
Thank you.
Seeing there's no further business in front of us, we'll see you on tomorrow. We're adjourned.